friends. We are back from a little disturbance in our schedule, but all is good, all is well, and we are glad to be back. You are, of course, listening to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for joining us this evening, day or morning, whatever it might be where you're at. Either you're listening to us through our archive at redicecreations.com or some of the other outlets on the web where we are featured, podcasts and whatnot. Today we have Daniel Tatman back on the show. Dan is the author of the upcoming book, The Bath Mysteries. You can read more about his upcoming title at his blog, thebathmysteries.blogspot.com. And we are going to go all the way back to one version of our roots today and open up the Bible and talk about some of the folks starring in Genesis. And Daniel, of course, have primarily focused on architecture in his research, or on symbolic or alchemical architecture around Bath in England, but also in other places and cities around the world. And I think we can keep this in the back of our minds here today as we begin to talk about Genesis and the first family of this story. But we're going to end up here in some pretty interesting areas, I think. So I'm looking forward to this very much. Welcome back to the show, Dan. Nice to have you with us again.
Hey there, Henrik. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. It always is.
It's excellent to have you, Dan. I know that you guys over there now have a huge, or big rather, snowstorm. Are you enjoying it so far over in the UK?
Yeah, it's been really nice. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, watching the rain in slow-mo, you know, I really enjoy it always.
Absolutely.
It's a magical time, you know.
Absolutely. I think it's great for you guys to get some snow over there. We have pretty much zero so far this winter, so I guess your guys are stealing it so far. All right. So let's see here. Before we begin, I guess, to open up our Bible and look at Genesis, look at Adam and Eve and some of their kids. Just tell us a little bit about what inspired you to look at this particular area that we'll be talking about here today, Dan.
Sure. Well, as I was trying to track the architecture around Bath, which led into the neoclassical architecture, which was prevalent at that time all around Europe and that spread around the world and that we now see everywhere, I was able to track this back to the architect Palladio, and the Palladian form of architecture. And his is regarded by the architectural world as kind of the best example of the copying of the styles of Vitruvius from ancient Rome. And so to really understand Palladio, and hence understand John Wood, who was very influenced by Palladio, I had to go into kind of the background of the Palladian architecture. Obviously, Palladianism is named after Andreas Palladio.
Yeah.
So it doesn't come from an earlier term. However, as I've mentioned before, there was kind of a synchronicity for Andreas, was that his real name wasn't Palladio. He originally came from a family of boatmen and traders, so his second name would be the English word for boatman.
Mm-hmm.
But it was after he built a villa at quite a young age for a very wealthy businessman, that the businessman gave him the nickname Palladio.
Hmm.
Because he thought that the architectural style which he used was so accurate to the Palladian style, or Palladian style,
mm-hmm.
But spelt with an O. And this referred back to the Parthenon and the Greek architects. So this guy, who was a very wealthy guy and was also involved with other various groups who had quite a lot of knowledge about the ancient mystery schools,
mm-hmm.
took Palladio under his wing and gave him this nickname. And the architectural style, obviously, that we talked about, these three classical orders of columns, and they've got a fascinating history.
Yes.
I mean, most of the establishment, they just track this back to Greece, and they'll stop there. For myself, I've seen that there's many, many routes, and we have direct artifacts and carvings and stelae which show that it was around much before that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also accepted by the top scholars, but it's not something that's generally talked about. But the columns, the classical orders of columns, were also found in the Etruscan civilization.
Ah, all the way back to the pre-Roman civilization.
Absolutely, yeah. And that the columns were actually adopted by the Romans from the Etruscans after what's known as the Battle of the City of Veii, which is in around 400 BC. And there were remnants of these columns and some of the buildings until the last 200 or 300 years, and they've been taken down. But the city of Veii was one of the richest cities of the Etruscans. And so it was one of the last to fall. It had a big army, and so they fought on for quite a while after the rest of the civilization had fallen.
Mm-hmm.
But we have one good example of this is a temple or a plaza in Rome called the Piazza Colonia.
Oh, yeah.
Which the columns which are around it, in any of the texts that you'll read on this structure, they will say that the columns that are used throughout it were taken from remnants of columns of the city of Veii.
Hmm.
So again, we have a direct connection of the overall overpowering of the Romans, of the Etruscans, and at that point absorbing something from them, kind of, you know, very in the fasci motif, the bundle of sticks all bound together.
Yes.
So we can see that this is something that the Romans did to a lot of the groups that they took over, that they absorbed something from that culture. And the columns seems to be one of the major ones. I mean, Gary Biltcliffe has done a very, very good lecture on the Etruscans called The Legacy of the Etruscans.
Absolutely. We had that linked up for our audience here who's listening on Red Ice a while back, and this is definitely something that people should take a look at again, because do you know if he goes into some of the specifics around the architecture connection here as you do?
Not so much. He focuses on the other very interesting aspect of the Etruscans, that they were very involved with building tumuli and dolmens and circular temples.
Yeah.
And also chambers which were dug into rock, into hillsides. So we have this fascinating overlap with the Etruscans. They seem to have been both the originators of the classical orders of columns, so a very ordered form of architecture, but also this architectural style, at least in the Italian arena, which would have mirrored what the Druidic building styles were of all of ancient Europe.
Yes.
That we find all over the region, you know, from France all the way up as far as Scandinavia and all the way back down again.
I mean, this thing about Palladian architecture has really opened up. It has shown itself to be a big mystery. Let me say it like that, because it's tied in with so many different aspects, and I think it's really, really fascinating. And I guess what you've been kind of trying to figure out as well is the roots or the origins or how far back this actually goes. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. Because as I said, you can read into the architecture of ancient Greece, and pretty much the buck stops there. Most of the books that you can find won't mention that they come from the Etruscan ancestors. But the fascinating thing, again, to go back to Palladio, the reason why this businessman, this wealthy guy, gave him this name was that the original name for Athena was Pallas Athene. She had a double-barreled name. And so we have the Palladion, or the Palladian pillar, which was always associated with Athena. And she's often shown, the goddess Athena, with the helmet of invisibility leaning back off her forehead.
Ah, right.
Standing next to a certain pillar, which is called the Palladian pillar. And so the whole connection here was something, again, which I think is referenced in the very fact of them calling him Palladio, instead of calling him Athenia, you know? Was that this guy, I think, was aware, that, as many people have been, that the Greek civilization came from the Etruscan. And that the Etruscan, when they talk about their ancestors, they talk about the Pelasgi, or the Pelasgians.
Yes.
Who worshipped a goddess named Pallas.
Hmm.
So we have, it seems, a very interesting overlap here also with the ancient goddess of the Pelasgians, or the early Etruscans, being known as Pallas, and then the Greeks adopting Athena. And in every single version of Greek mythology, there's around 12 different versions from different scholars and historians and philosophers from the period for a couple of hundred years. Every single version, Pallas is either the teacher, or the sister, or the foster sister, or the brother, or the companion of Athena.
Mm.
And in every single version, this isn't a sparse thing. In every single version, Pallas is killed either accidentally or inadvertently by Athena.
Okay.
And so Athena is so strucken with sorrow afterwards that she decides to change her name to Pallas Athene, and that she actually builds this Palladium pillar in memory of Pallas.
Hmm.
And so in a historical way, we could see this, that it's direct confirmation from Greek mythology that their goddess and their culture was taught to Athena, the mother of their pantheon, by an earlier goddess who was then killed by Athena, but that Athena absorbed a part of this essence. So we've got it direct in mythology saying that the ancient Greek came through the Etruscan and the Pelasgian.
Mm.
So we have this one side of the narrative of where people have thought, or various scholars or big minds over the years have thought, that this classical form of architecture comes from. It's the kind of straight through Greece and into its ancient roots.
Yes.
But then there's a whole another angle to look at from this, and this is the Christianized view.
Okay.
Come through Judaic scholars and Gnostics and other minds that have come since then that have been studying these works.
What I wanted to ask as well is that, you know, what I find interesting and fascinating about this is the idea that we have talked on the program before about the Palladian Rite as well, something that kind of trickles through the secret society as well, a kind of an undercurrent of this. Do you think that this has to do a direct link with the goddess worship of Pallas Athena in that sense, or do you think there is even more to the story than that? There's so much to say about it, obviously. There's so much to say about it, obviously. But in a general term.
Yeah. Generally, I think that the main people that have even talked about the Palladian Rite,
mm-hmm.
or the main sources that are used, probably aren't the best sources for historical or kind of factual information. I mean, most of the information that we have comes from Christian scholars that were using it as a way of attacking Freemasonry through certain parts of the history. And obviously,
yeah.
It's not just an attack on Freemasonry, that there was an element of Freemasonry creating this attack on itself.
Hmm.
So it was named after the Taxil hoax, one of the wildest and largest hoaxes in all time.
Yes.
And I don't think that it was all a joke. I think that there was an element to it which was truthful, but so many of the accounts that we have of it don't really come from very good sources.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me, I feel, to run with all of the ideas that have been spread about the Palladian Rite. But we could say that ideologically the Palladian Rite would be connected to the ancient Greek mysteries and the mysteries of Samothrace and Athena.
Yes.
And all of these ancient cults did encompass both sides, both male and female,
yeah.
priestesses and priests. And so this was one of the major things which almost all of the writers share in common, is that they say that in the Palladian Rite there were both male and female adepts,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that they would use sexual magic or tantric magic. And I don't rule this out.
Yeah.
That it may have come ideologically through that, or that people may have interpreted it that way. But I can't see enough impartial evidence and information to really say that is the case to me. But I
right.
don't rule it out. You know.
Well, there's definitely something there, and something worth looking into. There, I mean, it's a huge area. And again, Daniels, we have done these programs with you and with others as well that has talked a little bit more about the Palladian Rite specifically. A picture starts to emerge definitely here that something has definitely to do with Palladia and the importance of Palladia. So it's a huge area. The question then is if we should jump upon the Genesis story here straight away, or is it something more you want to touch upon when we're talking about the Etruscans or the background story to this?
No, I think that, you know, people could look themselves, because that's a huge section of history. I mean, Greek mythology is vast. I mean, you know, one other example of another detail surrounding Pallas is that her father is a guy called Nalaikon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually from this character in mythology that we have the start of the whole werewolf idea.
Uh-huh, okay.
And you know, recent films have popularized this, that the vampire race have created another race to be their slaves that they call the Lycans.
Yes.
The werewolves. And this does come from Greek mythology, with this king who was supposedly doing sacrifices to Zeus. And Zeus was unhappy with the sacrifice and so turned him into a wolf. So this is the first time in history we ever have talk of a werewolf, at least in kind of Western history, you know?
Yeah, interesting.
It comes from the father of Pallas. But yeah, that's just one example of the amount of connections that there are. And I mean, Lycan is supposedly, he had 50 sons. So again, you know, this is so big, it doesn't really do it justice for me to lay it out. I can talk about some of the things which seem to connect.
Mm.
Really, for those sort of things with mythology, it's best for people to go and look at it themselves.
Absolutely. Is there anything specific you'd like to recommend? Where would be a good source to begin looking into some of this?
Sure. I mean, all of this information is online now. I mean, you've got sacredtext.com and many others that you can go to straight from the Roman and the Greek philosophers talking about all of these mythologies, you know?
Yeah.
So there's many places, and I wouldn't really recommend one over the other, because many are interpreted or differently translated as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
You have to read a lot to really get an oversight over all of it anyway.
That's the idea, definitely. Okay, so Genesis, the beginning of one version of our background or history of our roots, lead us into this topic a little bit, Dan.
Absolutely. Well, this is, again, because of trying to understand Bath and trying to use John Wood as one of its sort of main components to understand the ideas that went into his buildings. Wood also placed importance upon the Temple of Solomon, but following in the kind of the Christian or Christianized philosophical view, he believed that the classical orders of columns from ancient Greece originally came from the Temple of Solomon.
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, this is something which people, I don't think, have been told or they're aware of. There's all the ideas about ancient Greece going through to Etruria, but the ideas of the Jewish or the Hebrewic connection to classical architecture is something which not many people are aware of, you know.
No, I never heard of it in that context, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. And so, with Wood placing so much importance on the Temple of Solomon, I wanted to go into why he felt this. So, the reference for people who want to find out about that, they could look at, I think that it is online, you can look for the book, The Origins of Building and the Plagiarism of the Heathens, by John Wood.
Oh, cool. All right.
Which I've mentioned before, which is one of his main works that he wrote about. As the title says, The Origins of Building, as he saw it.
Okay, yeah.
And in that, he refers to the works of Josephus and other Judaic historians who talk often about what Josephus calls, anyway, he's one example, of what he calls the sons of Seth.
Yes.
In particular, the pillars of the sons of Seth. And this comes from the Antiquities of the Jews. By Josephus.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes that the pillars of the sons of Seth were two columns or pillars, one made of brick and one made of one piece of stone, solid stone, and that they were built so that if the world went through a deluge or through a trial of fire, that one or the other would survive.
That is fascinating.
These columns were meant to be absolutely covered in mathematical knowledge.
Okay.
Symbolic knowledge, geometric knowledge, and astronomical knowledge. And we have some obviously big overlaps going on there, straight from the offset of two pillars, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm running into Freemasonry.
Jachin and Boaz.
There's Jachin and Boaz, you know?
Yes.
And obviously the idea which Ralph Ellis has been coming forward now with and the alternative views of Jesus and the rest of the group that we would associate with early Christianity. He makes the idea that Josephus is St. Paul.
Yes.
And so that's a whole can of worms there. So that's a huge one.
Yes.
So we've got possibly St. Paul talking about these two columns, which then go on to be very important within various mystery schools and notably Freemasonry, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So in order to understand more about what Josephus meant, because he doesn't really write a huge amount about it, all of the references that come from scholars, they just make a sort of glancing point about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They don't really go into it. So you have to go back then to the biblical account to see, you know, who Seth was. It's a name which everybody would know would be a biblical name. And most people, you know, are aware of it. It's not kind of out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
But what people aren't aware of a lot of the time is of the first five people in the narrative of the Bible.
Mm.
He's the one that people aren't aware of, you know. So it's very, very strange. You know, you've got Adam and Eve.
Yes.
Cain and Abel. And then Seth. Seth is the third son.
The third son, yes.
Yeah. But it's very interesting, you know, if you're to take it literally, there's only five people on earth. And all of Western culture has been permeated with Christian ideology and myths. You know, most of us know the stories from the Old Testament. And but yet people know so little about the fifth character.
That is very true.
The king of the world.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that is very interesting in itself, that people focus on Cain and Abel. And so the general outline of it is that Adam and Eve are created. They get moved out of the Garden of Paradise after eating from the tree. Immediately, Adam knows his wife. This is the way the Bible would recount it. And Cain is born.
Yes.
So then, after some time after that, Abel is born. So you have the two first sons of Adam. Then the story which everybody knows is of Cain and Abel both being asked by God to offer a sacrifice.
Mm.
And Cain, again, this is all comes from chapter 4 of Genesis. Anybody can go back and look at this.
Mm.
That Cain is known for tilling the land and working as a farmer. And that Abel is known as a shepherd. And so the two sacrifices, one is a sacrifice of the first animals of Abel's flock.
Mm-hmm.
And Cain brings an offering from the land. And it's very interesting, you know, that this God who's meant to be the omnipotent, loving God,
mm-hmm.
associated with Christianity, takes such a disliking to one of the offerings that he refuses to take it.
Yes, yes.
I find that fascinating. I think there's a real stream of ideas that's coming through there that obviously isn't necessarily divine.
You want the...
But is attributed to a god, you know?
Yes. He wants the flesh and the blood, as it were.
It seems to be. Give me an offering, you know, and it's not like, oh, well, yeah, that's from the land. You know, he condemns Cain for it. And so Cain becomes broken down in spirit and eventually decides to take Abel out to the field to tell him that he's going to show him something, and hits him over the head with a rock and kills him.
Mm.
So we have the first murder on earth, on the biblical tradition.
Didn't take long, did it?
It doesn't, does it?
Jeez, yeah.
And so... God, seeing this, marks Cain and kicks him out of the Holy Land. So they're no longer in the Garden of Paradise, but they are in the Holy Land surrounding the Garden, the Paradise that is Eden, you know. And so the reason that God marks Cain is that he, you know, Cain is terrified that he's going to be killed by the other people.
Yes, there's more out there. That's interesting.
So there's obviously more out there. So again, the rabbinical translation or understanding of these first figures is that they're less people as they are whole groups of people, almost civilizations, you know?
Yeah.
And so Cain is marked with a certain mark so that none of the other people out there will kill him. And he leaves, and he goes, and he founds the first city. And of course, again, you can't found a city of one person. So the first city comes up under Cain. After around 80 years or thereabouts, it's kind of sketchy, the account that it gives of the timeline. Adam and Eve, again, sit down together, lay down together, and Seth is produced.
Yes.
And Seth is supposedly, or as known again through the Christian or the Judaic translation, is appointed. The name Seth means appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into it that Eve believed that Seth had been appointed to her after Abel had been killed. So there was already this importance placed upon Seth as God being more involved with Seth than he was with Cain and Abel.
Ah, I see.
Because he's seen as somehow more divine.
Mm.
So that's interesting straight off the bat. But then the importance of Seth is that all of the Canaanites, the people who come from the line of Cain, are supposedly wiped out after the flood.
Mm.
So the only people left are the people from the other side of the family tree of Adam, you know, who are all of the sons of Seth. Again, as Josephus was talking about, Josephus refers to them as a more divine, special group of people who are the elect, who are spiritually and ergonomically, he says they're actually larger, that they're an elect of people.
Do you think any of the giant or even Nephilim think is involved in this?
It seems to be, but it seems to be flipped around the other way.
Hmm.
So, and that's an interesting point, is that it's usually the Canaanites, the Philistines, and these groups who are considered the giants.
Yes.
And the Israelites, who again, as the rabbis would tell you, have come from the line of Seth and Noah, you know, they're not giants because the Philistines and the Canaanites look like giants compared to them.
Yes.
But this is something which has been brought forward, a concept by Joseph Farrell. And he's one of the only people who I've heard actually mention it. Is just in mainstream history, or mixing between biblical history and actual history, we have the Jewish people, or the Hebrews, being taken into captivity by the Babylonians and by the Egyptians, by both of the, what we call, legacy civilizations of modern society.
Right.
And at both points, when the Jews come into contact with them, it pretty much singles the end of the civilization, you know.
Hmm.
So Farrell brings up the point that he's not really sure, he's still playing with ideas, but that it may be that they were actually sent there to do this. That these were a group of people who were sent, they weren't so much sent into captivity, but that sent into an area which was developing in order to take down that civilization.
Uh-huh.
I find that a very interesting point, you know, especially coming from a Christian.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of other ideas surrounding the Hebrews and the early Hebrews and who they were, coming from all the scholars that have been around up till now, you know, and some of the newer ideas.
Yes.
But again, to get back to Seth, Seth, as we've noted, doesn't play that large a role, even though he's really important, obviously, from the straight Old Testament view, that all of the line of Israel and David and Solomon, that these people all come from Seth. You don't really get much about him in Genesis. They pretty much go straight into the children that he has. And this is very interesting because in the apocryphal texts that are included in the Catholic Bible, in some of them, and also some of the Gnostic texts as well.
Mm.
They have an appendium, kind of, to the Pentateuch. They have a prologue which goes through the eons of development before the start of the Old Testament.
Okay.
And this goes into what John Lash has been talking about with the aeons, the deities which are involved with different levels of creation.
Ah, yes, that's true.
Which eventually come to Sophia.
Yes.
and the creation, you know, of the new race on Earth and Gaia. And so, whereas in the mainstream Old Testament or Christian view, Seth doesn't play much importance. In the Gnostic view, Seth is the most important person.
It sounds to me already that...
That's got two, kind of the two sides of arguably one doctrine.
Well, exactly. The
talks about one figure, you know, exclusively. They place paramount importance on him. And the other group also accepts that he's important, but doesn't talk about him.
Do you think we have that split here of the esoteric and the exoteric? Like right there, they're splitting up. We have the hermetic on one side and the prosaic on the other, basically.
Yeah, I think that could definitely be the case. I mean, Josephus, when he's writing this, is around, you know, just post-Jesus. And he's around with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and these Jews who would have been kind of like a proto-Talmudic form of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys dislike the Gnostics and all these other sects as well, you know.
Yes.
So I'd say that, yeah, that's definitely what we have. We have kind of the institutionalized Christian chronology and history going through the Old Testament. And then we have this other side, which was only really taught in more out-of-the-way areas that weren't affected by the main governance, the church. So we have the two sides of the story. Yeah, following on with looking at Genesis in connection with Cain, Abel, and Seth, the three first sons of Adam, you know. And in a way, you know, we could see that these three children are kind of a device, because in pretty much every world faith, you know, even the more modern forms, you know, you have the three pillars of Islam.
Yes.
Which are kind of three fundamental laws. And they're always shown next to pillars also.
Hmm.
You have the three lights of Freemasonry, which is known as the square, the compass, and the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the Holy Trinity of the Catholic Church. So we often have this, the Trinity, the three, used as a device. And you can see that it's being used here in Genesis, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, the three pillars, the three columns again.
Would you say, could one even interpret this, like, in the context of, well, I don't know, Cain is like, to represent the broken pillar, or the one that, you know, didn't make it in that sense, and then we have Seth, like the last one is the crowning one, I guess we can say, or represented by the Corinthian. Would that be too far?
I guess you could say that. You know, I perhaps would think that was going too far, but definitely the metaphor is there, and you could use it that Cain being the first son would have kind of been one of the, you know, would be like the Doric,
yeah,
the simple column.
Yeah.
Abel as the second column would be Ionic. And then Seth would be the Corinthian, the flowering.
Yes.
You know? And so, yeah, you could definitely see it that way.
Interesting.
It's more perhaps just as I said, of it being used as a device of the Trinity, of this primordial three, which no matter which faith you look into, the primordial three always birth what they call the 10,000 things.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely.
So perhaps, you know, you could overlay the columns over that concept. I'm not so sure about that, but again, I'm open to it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of the continuation then, so Abel's out of the picture. He's been killed. Cain has left the land of Eden and gone to the land of Nod, as it's referred to in the Bible. I mean, it actually says the land of Nod, east of Eden. So it gives you a geographical location of it as well. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And starts the first city. Then back in the holy side of the valley, you know,
mm-hmm.
you've got these two sides have kind of emerged. Seth also knows his wife. Apparently, you know, there's more children there.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Straight away.
Yep.
So Seth knows his wife and has a son. Who sometimes is, or it depends on which translation you look at, and I find this interesting, that sometimes he's named Enos, sometimes Enosh,
yes,
or sometimes Enoch. Now, this is really, really interesting, because they've opened up kind of a duality, because Cain's first son is named Enoch.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So on one side of the valley, Seth's son is Enoch, and then on the other side of the valley, you've got Cain and his son Enoch.
Mm.
So again, if we were to take this back to kind of two sides developing, we have the two Enochs, who kind of seem to mirror each other.
Yeah.
And in a modern context, we could pick up the ball, and I think this is really fascinating, that we have, through the early church, only allowed theurgy. Theurgy, in its truest sense, was meant to have come from the writings of Enoch.
Okay. Mm.
But then also, in the modern magical realms, we have John Dee creating Enochian magic.
Indeed, yeah.
So we have two Enochian forms of magic on opposing sides.
Hmm.
That's fascinating. It has these straight run-ons from this duality noted in this person in early biblical traditions, coming all the way up to the actual forms of magic, which were and weren't allowed, you know.
Hmm.
They both come from Enoch. But there's some ambiguation about which Enoch it is. You know, perhaps they're both talking about the same one.
Could be.
They're talking about different ones. We can't even tell.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Enosh is
a fascinating concept, the two Enochs. And again, we could say that this was kind of a parallel to the pillars of the sons of Seth again.
Ah, yeah.
These two pillars. But again, this is kind of a metaphysical understanding of it. You know, it's kind of slotting pieces into each other. So perhaps we should kind of take that out of it, because it could kind of confuse the matter a little bit.
But it's interesting to note, nonetheless, that things are. The water is this muddy from the get-go, so to speak. Nothing is really clear, and it's very open for interpretation, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, overall, with Josephus writing about the pillars of the sons of Seth, and the various Gnostic sects which came out of this kind of body of knowledge, we have some very, very different views on the Bible, as I mentioned, to the modern interpretation of the Old Testament, you know?
Yes.
And we're going back to this concept of the archons through the Gnostics. And the Gnostic, or the what has been called the Christian Gnostic doctrine, comes through a group that are known as the Sethians.
Sethian?
Yeah, quite literally.
Ah.
So they're, you know, the followers of Seth. And the Sethian doctrine was espoused by Philo and many others in the early Alexandrian church also. And these became the kind of the foundations of what has been called Christian Gnosticism, but what I'd say is more rightly called Judaic Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
Because how can you say something is Christian if it's pre-Christian?
That's true.
That's
yeah.
Kind of, you're connecting something in the past with something that hasn't arrived yet.
Exactly, yeah.
So it would be like calling the Britons the Proto-Romans or something.
You know? Right.
It's very funny that they allowed that reference to be used so much. But
good point.
The view of these Gnostics which came through the Sethians were rife at this point in the early church. And we see this in many sects which people can Google up on, you know, the Thomasines, the Basildeans, the Venetians, or the Venetinians, and very many other sects that were very, very important in the early conception of Christianity. And funnily enough, were also connected with the earliest forms of British Christianity.
Mm.
The British Celtic Church was very connected with the Alexandrian Church of Egypt and Greece, you know.
Ah, okay, interesting.
So these same ideas not only run through the Gnostic sects, they also cross over into the Eastern Orthodox Catholicism, which I guess people call Catholicism again, but it's very, very different. It's a lot more based on Greek interpretations of things and connecting it again with Hermeticism, quite clearly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we have in the Eastern Orthodox, again, a remnant of some of these mystical Christian practices which came from an earlier form of Gnosis, which, again, to refer to John Lash, he picks up the ball on this, saying quite rightly that Gnosis is kind of a term that we've relayed to these early Christians, but the whole process of worship and the way of life of these people came from the earlier indigenous shamans.
Yes.
And that this would be the truest form of gnosis, would be the indigenous elders. And so that's why this term is kind of connected with them. And the, you know, the later forms of this, you could go into, you know, the Carolinians and the Cathars and other groups. And this, you could quite rightly say, would be Christian Gnosticism. But all of the groups which are pre-Christian, you know?
Yes.
You can't really make that parallel.
Yes.
But the importance of Seth is noted by all of these Gnostic sects. And here's, again, just one example of one story, which is in the non-canonical Book of Adam, known as. And it recounts that Adam, on his deathbed, realizes he's going to die and has this vision. And that the earth is going to be destroyed twice, once by fire and once by water. And so he tells Seth to go back to paradise, to go back to the Garden of Eden. And Seth toddles back over to Eden, goes up to the gates of the Garden of Paradise, and the angel, or the archangel Michael, is there with his flaming sword. And Seth tells him why he's there, that he's been sent by his father. And Adam had sent him to the garden to retrieve three seeds from the tree of life, from the center of the garden. And so Seth goes, he's allowed to pass by Michael, by the archangel Michael, and he goes into paradise and he takes three seeds from the tree of life and he returns back to Adam. And in this time, Adam's already died, but he instructed Seth that if he did die, that he should place the seeds in his mouth. And then bury him. So, again, in the Gnostic account that we have, or the various Gnostic accounts, because they all pretty much corroborate this, that Seth buries his father Adam, and from these three seeds sprout three trees and a huge lake, kind of a spring or a fountain in front of them. And then this was carried on into medieval legend by some of the sort of the alchemical or Dark Ages scholars, where they said that these were the three trees which were cut down and actually used as the crosses on Golgotha.
Okay.
To crucify Jesus and the two others. So, again, it just shows that there's a huge amount of mythology and other ideas and stories surrounding all of these figures from the early Bible.
Yes.
And if we just take the New King James Version, you have nothing. You don't find out anything. They mention, you know, another point worth mentioning is that they only mention the names of the sons, you know, for quite a while. Then they start giving the names of the daughters, you know, but obvious placing of importance upon the male line rather than the female line shows a bias, you know.
That is interesting because it the King James Version seems to be a version that many, you know, more kind of, I guess, kind of hardcore researchers and scholars are looking towards as the true source. I mean, that's the, what do they call it? The authorized version, right, of King James.
Yeah, the authorized version of King James.
Yes.
Really, you know? I think it came from around 1616.
Yes.
You know, that's pretty late in the day.
It's very late.
It was written.
Very late.
Or when of the Bible's contemporaries were writing, you know? It's a long, long distance.
Absolutely.
I don't know why he specifically felt that he had the insight to be able to correct this and take bits out and amend it, you know. It seems pretty ridiculous to me that a lot of Christians do cling to that. But that's only my personal view. I'm not forcing that on others. But
no, sure.
I do find that interesting, you know.
Absolutely. And it's worth mentioning and bringing it up because, again, it's very late and it's just so many other sources you can look at, you know, from the Septuagint that was basically translated, I think, from Aramaic over to Greek. That's one version, and I personally don't know if there's any kind of good you know, translations of that into English or whatnot. And of course there is a language barrier, so to speak, to cross where words we use today might not, you know, have been around back then, or the other way around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we have a lot of really, really interesting other ideas surrounding these people. And it's so interesting that one version, but by any group of people, you know, would be so highly prized above all of the others.
Yeah.
You know, that obviously in itself is there's something very interesting being expressed in that, and you know, I find that a lot of the kind of newer Protestant research community, you know, there's a lot of modern Christian views upon things in theology, and they really do hold true to the New King James, you know, and really attack the Catholic versions and things like this.
Yes.
But the real top scholars in Bible translation know that some of the most authentic material that you can get from the early church fathers and the text themselves comes from Greece.
Yeah.
And it comes through the Greek line, you know.
Yes.
And so many of the top scholars within the Christian community and the you know, the atheistic or non-conformist community or whatever, try to go back to these Greek texts alongside the Dead Sea Scrolls and the recent Nag Hammadi texts that were found, you know?
Yes.
So this seems to be more of an accurate line of research for the inquiring Christian or just historian. And yet, in the modern Christian movement, a lot of emphasis is placed on a version or an authorized version of the Bible that's authorized by a king.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
He's not exactly the most spiritual person.
Well, I've heard he was divinely inspired by God when he sat down and rewrote it, I think so.
Yeah, well, they all were, weren't they?
Well, exactly. That's a good point.
All the people that sat down to amend it were guided by the Holy Spirit. You know?
Yes.
So
yes.
In that way, the Bible itself becomes deified, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not an account of people talking about people and, you know, their experience of God. It's kind of all saints and powerful patriarchs that, you know, completely true. And you know, it's very interesting. So much importance is placed on these figures. If you were to talk about Noah or Moses or some of the other ideas surrounding them, you will be attacked by a lot of people.
Sure, sure.
Because they really like to build these people up, you know.
Yeah.
The origins of civilization, as far as they see it, and they see these people as very noble, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I think it would be more realistic to see them as people.
That's a good point.
They are humans. They have emotions, you know, they're people. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's see here. I think we are kind of slowly approaching the end here of our first hour. What do you think, Dan? Should we carry on? I mean, there's much more we can talk about when it comes to Newton and John Wood, I guess, and tie this in more maybe with the Temple of Solomon. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we should carry on.
Carry on. Absolutely.
Look through the rest.
But why don't we take a short break here? We can listen to some nice music, take a little breather for a while, and then come back and continue carrying on here. But before we do that, Dan, go ahead and mention your blog, your website, of course, so people can find out a little bit more about you, your background, and find some of the interviews you've done and so forth.
Sure, yeah. The website is thebathmysteries.blogspot.com. And in the next couple of weeks, I think, or perhaps months, there's going to be one of the talks that I've done at Bury St. Edmunds for the Stars and Stones Forum.
Mm-hmm.
So people will be able to watch a lecture of some of my information that I brought forward. But that will be to come, and I guess we could give people an update on the show.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, if they'd like to go to the website. I mean, the website hasn't been keeping up with where I'm at. It's kind of just been an introduction to the city and to the study. So, you know, for people just to get a bit more of a concept of which angle I'm coming at, then it's a good place to start, you know.
Absolutely, very good. And there's more
building that up in the months to come.
Yes,
you know, have a bit more free time.
And there's more information about how to pre-order your book, of course, with the same title, The Bath Mysteries, on that website, and an email address to Dan and so forth. We will have this.
There's a pre-order button there.
Yes, very good. I think we are going to have your link up on the website, redicecreations.com, as well, to the bathmysteries.blogspot.com. So do check that out. Stay with us, Dan. Thank you very much here for this first segment, and we'll talk after the break.
Okay, thanks a lot, Henry.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. And she broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the floor. You know, I used to live alone before I knew you. And I've seen your flag on the marble arch. And love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah. Time when you let me know what's really going on below, but now you never show that to me, do you? But remember when I moved in you, and the holy dove was moving too, and every breath we drew is hallelujah, hallelujah. Hallelujah, It's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken heart.